we begin, our next speaker is Sergey Morris, and he's going to tell us about effective field theories of planar power superfluid.
All right, so it's my great pleasure to be here. Yeah, and today I would like to talk about effective theories of chiral fermionic superfluids living in two dimensions. So I will tell you so that this superfluidity appears in when we have fermions which interact through P-wave interaction. And so my interest in P-wave comes from our institution. So in front of our building, we have this monument, and whenever I go to a colloquium, I start to think what did they mean by that, and this leads me to think about P-waves. So it's not surprising that I'm talking about, also it's Perimeter Institute, but okay. So I'm talking about P-wave superfluids. So I will, here is the outline of my talk. So I will start by just reviewing the superfluidity and also telling you about chiral superfluidity in two spatial dimensions. So these superfluids, they have kind of, they are exotic in some sense, so they have new features such as Hall viscosity and edge currents, and I will introduce this phenomena. And so our aim is to construct an effective field theory of Goldstone bosons, which will incorporate this phenomena, so both Hall viscosity and edge currents. So I will tell you how we construct the effective field theory, and then I'll show you some applications. So we applied it to calculate linear response to external gravitational and electromagnetic field, and also we calculated a vortex, isolated vortex in a superfluid, and we kind of wanted to understand how vortices and antivortices, how they differ in chiral superfluids. And yeah, finally, I'll talk a little bit about reformulation of the theory in terms of gauge theory. So this is work together with Carlos Hoyos and Damson. So, and I do not have many slides, so I encourage you to ask me at any point if anything is unclear.
What is the picture in the upper right corner?
Okay, this one. It's a content, so it's like outline or summary. So I will have, you want to know exactly. Okay, this probably goes beyond my knowledge, yeah. So you will see a lot of pictures in this corner. So I like to put pictures to make it a little bit less dense. Okay, so superfluids is an old subject. So usually, so we have superfluidity if we have low temperature many body system which is neutral, so it's not electrically charged. So then usually systems become superfluid at low temperatures, and so they have this well-known phenomena such as there is a flow which has no dissipation. There are topological defects, topologically stable objects like quantum vortices. And there are many more other things. We will talk about some of them. And so, yeah, the theory of superfluidity was triggered, of course, by experiments. So in early 20th century, it was shown that helium-4 at few kelvins become superfluid, so it exhibits flow without, with no dissipation. And half a decade later, or even more, in 1970s, it was shown that at the millikelvin regime, helium-3 actually also becomes superfluid. So this, so helium-4 is bosonic and helium-3 is fermionic. So these systems, they served as a systems where all the theory, main theory, was developed of superfluidity. So nowadays we have many more superfluids to work with. So, and this is partially due to the advent of experiments with ultra-cold quantum gases. So in these experiments, they can prepare superfluids in a very controlled way, in a sense that they can control the strength of interaction of atoms. They can control the geometry where the atoms live. So nowadays one can study different superfluids in great detail. So I'm going to talk about chiral superfluidity in two spatial dimensions. So to realize it, what we need are spinless fermions, so single component non-relativistic fermions, which live in 2D. So this the spinless fermions, they cannot interact in S wave, so they, but if they attract in P wave, they will form a condensate. And this condensate, the condensate which is preferred has this form. So the condensate as a function of P is a product of Px plus minus Ipy. So it's written in momentum space times some function of a modulus of P. So that's why it's called chiral. So we have this Cooper pair has a definite angular momentum, and plus or minus defines the chirality of the condensate. So these are two degenerate states with the same energy. So this is an interesting condensate because for several reasons. So one of them is that this system at zero temperature exhibits topological quantum phase transition. So what I mean by that is that if you change the chemical potential or you change the strength of the interaction, there is a quantum phase transition, but on the both sides you have this kind of condensate, and that's why it's topological, because what happens actually is the topology of the ground state changes as we cross this critical value of the chemical potential. So and this quantum critical point, it's important because we have, if we have a topologically non-trivial state, so BCS in this case, if we have a boundary of this state, which I realized is like a boundary of a sample, or maybe a boundary of a vortex, if you wish, so then at that point the fermionic the gap for fermions closes, and we have chiral modes which have Majorana nature, so they are sitting at the boundary. And so these Majorana modes are kind of interesting for in condensed matter, because they are non-abelian. They have fractional non-abelian statistics, so they are good for manipulation and for developing a fault-tolerant quantum computer. So if this is kind of too fancy, then one can just go back to helium 3 and say that what we have here is a kind of a toy model for helium 3, where there is no spin degrees of freedom. So we have just orbital pairing. So this can be actually realized if we apply a strong magnetic field which will polarize the spins. So this is in a certain extent a model of helium 3. And also there is a relation to quantum Hall physics. So the nu equals 5 over 2 quantum Hall state or Moore-Reed state can be mapped into, by attaching fluxes to fermions, so it can be mapped into this problem. So chiral superfluidity appears in different problems in two dimensions. And our aim is to build an effective field theory for that. So what we need first, we need to identify how many, we have continuous symmetry breaking. So we have to identify how many Goldstone bosons are there, which control our theory. So for this, we look at the condensate, and we see that there are two kind of break-ins here. So first of all, we have a usual U1 particle number break-in, which just multiplies this by a complex phase. But also we can rotate the chiral part. So we can have we have here a SO2 Thielbein rotational symmetry which is broken. So but you see that although they are both broken, you can make a combination of them such that the condensate is preserved. So there is a diagonal U1 subgroup which is invariant. So this is our symmetry breaking pattern. And from here you see that there is just, since we have this, so actually the relative symmetry is broken. This means that there is only single gapless Goldstone mode here. So the theory will be quite simple. It has just 1 degree of freedom. And what we also see from the condensate, and this is very important, is that both parity and time reversal are broken by the condensate. So if we change time, this will swap sign, and also parity, 2D parity defined by the swapping of the axis. 2D parity is defined by going from x and y to minus x and y. So this is also broken. So, and this will lead to new effects. Okay, so now let me tell you about this new phenomena which appear in this parity and time reversal broken superfluid. So first of all, we expect, we know that the ground state has an angular momentum. It's a collection of Cooper pairs which rotate coherently. So this means that there is a total angular momentum, and this total angular momentum has to be carried by some current. So this current is a H particle current. So here is a kind of a loose picture of that. So we have a collection of Cooper pairs. They kind of rotate in the same direction. When you're inside, the rotation kind of cancel each other and there is no current. But if you go closer to the edge, there is a current. So, and this current circulates where the density changes, so close to the surface. And so now, yeah, if you calculate this angular momentum with this current, so this current, as I told you, it flows in the ground state. So if you calculate that, you should get the total angular momentum, which is nothing but the number of Cooper pairs. So it's number of particles fermions divided by 2, because every Cooper pair carries one unit of angular momentum. So this definitely should come out of our theory. And another thing which should come of our theory is the Hall viscosity. So the Hall viscosity is a specific to 2-dimension. And it happens when time reversal is broken. So it was studied in 90s by Everon, Seiler, and Zograf. And so what it means is the following. So we in this time reversal system, 2-dimensional system, we can write a correction to the stress tensor. So which is written here. So this is the strain rate. So the symmetric combination of derivative of the velocity, superfluid velocity in our case. And here you see it looks like shear viscosity, but there is epsilon here instead of G. So you see that if you calculate the force which is generated by this correction, you get nabla, also you get Laplace acting on V, but there is epsilon here, so it points perpendicular to the Laplace of Vj. So this means that this is a non-dissipative effect, and it should be reproduced by our theory as well. So and this there are so the systems. By now, there are a lot of systems which kind of basically, whenever we have time reversal breaking, we expect Hall viscosity to appear. So it appears in integer and fractional quantum Hall effect, and also in our P plus IP superfluid. And basically, the Hall viscosity has a dimensionality of H bar over L squared. So it measures the angular momentum density of the system. Okay. So these are two exotic phenomena, if you wish, and we need to incorporate it into our theory of our theory of superfluids. So how we do that? So we will do the following. So we will put our superfluid into a curved space and also turn on an electromagnetic source. So this is very useful because we can easily then calculate the currents and the stress tensor out of that. So this both the metric and the electromagnetic field are background fields, so they have no dynamics. So we have a superfluid on some background, and we will assume, or we will that this theory should be invariant with respect to the U1 gauge transformation and also with respect to general coordinate transformations, non-relativistic general coordinate transformations. Okay, is there a question?
You're assuming that it's also perfectly incompressible.
No. So my superfluid does not have to. So it's a superfluid, right? So it has a soft Goldstone mode. So it will be compressible superfluid. What I assume is exact Galilean invariance. So So that's, so there are no kind of impurities or things like that. But my superfluid will be a compressible. Why do you think it should be incompressible?
Well, how does it respond to that that interesting metric that you appear to have drawn?
How it responds?
So you have a curved space with a fluid in it.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So does the density of the fluid respond to the curvature of the metric?
Yes.
I see.
Okay, so here what I write is the form of the transformation law. So we have this Goldstone field, I will call it theta. So, and for further reference, it can be split into two pieces. One comes from the ground state, so it's basically the chemical potential stands here, and this phi is a fluctuation, phonon fluctuation around the ground state. So this theta should transform as a, it has no indices, it should transform as a scalar under non-relativistic diffeomorphisms, which is denoted by psi here. So
that, before we go further with this, did you say that I miss it? Why you put this in a curved background? It's a convenient probe. It's a trick, basically. But I don't think you said why you.
Yeah, there might be different reasons for that. So first, it's a convenient way how to calculate currents, stress tensors, and so on in flat space.
Right.
So this is one thing. Another thing is that this symmetry is basically stronger, so I'm getting to that, than pure Galilean transformation. So we kind of make a local version of Galilean transformation. So we hope to get more constraints.
Okay, but why do you think the physics has that symmetry?
Why the physics has this symmetry?
Yeah.
So if you write down a free, I do not know, free fermions, non-relativistic fermions. So this symmetry is kind of a broader class of symmetries of the system. So it's for this reason I want to have this symmetry in my description. I would like to have I can prepare, let's say, a sphere and put a superfluid onto it. So there is a way how to put a superfluid into curved space. So and I'm just trying to do that and see if it will give me more constraints than just starting from pure Galilean symmetry or not. But you can view it really also as a mathematical trick how to get currents if you. Yeah, but it will give us a stronger constraint than just starting with a Galilean theory in flat space. Yeah.
You're just assuming that the microphysics has this symmetry.
Yes. Yes.
So it should be reproduced.
This should be reproduced by effective field theory. Yes. Exactly. My microscopic model should have this symmetry. So if I put my fermions onto curved space, it should respect this symmetry.
If you have written down the action for fermions interacting with the gauge field and the metric in the most simple way, then the symmetry is manifested in this model.
Yes. Yes. So the microscopic model has this symmetry, and we would like our effective field theory to have this symmetry as well. Yeah.
I mean, that's a general statement about any effective field theory, right?
Yes.
The question is, how do you know when you're going to gain information by doing this and when you're not?
What do you mean by that?
So what you're saying is that, look, if I construct this from a generally covariant theory and then take a limit, then this is you.
Which kind of limit?
Take a non-relativistic limit.
No, I do not want to take a non-relativistic limit. I can start from non-relativistic theory, see that the symmetry is there, microscopic one, and then I would like to build an effective field theory of Goldstone bosons, which will have the same symmetry as well. I can do it with a limit as well, but I do not have to.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. Suppose you do it for a standard S-wave superconductor.
Yes.
Will there be some key difference? Or?
No, actually for S-wave, it depends I will maybe mention that. So it depends which order in derivative expansion you are going, but leading order will reproduce the Galilean invariant theory.
Right, so I guess that was my question. How do you know in which cases you're going to gain information by doing?
You can construct most general invariants in this with this symmetry and with Galilean invariants and compare if they
right,
are.
Right, but a priori you're saying it's not clear whether or not you know you're going to gain anything or not.
Probably, yeah. Yes. So it turns out that, yeah, in higher orders, it usually constrains more, yeah.
Sorry, if you take the conventional Ginzburg-Landau theory,
okay,
for superconductor and put it on a sphere, do you claim that this kind of thing will automatically follow at low energy?
So Ginzburg-Landau?
Yeah.
So I'm exactly at zero temperature. So my Ginzburg-Landau usually is near critical temperature, right? Somehow. But yeah, so I think, yeah, so if I start with a microscopic model of P-wave interacting fermions,
it will follow,
yeah. Anyway, so this is the transformation loss. So under this diffeomorphisms denoted by Xi, so the Goldstone boson transforms as a scalar. Then we have background gauge fields, so the scalar part and time component and the spatial component. So it transforms basically as a one form with the important correction which appears here. So this psi dot, which makes it kind of a modification. And then we have a metric which transforms as a tensor. And as I said, yeah, this generalizes. So it's a kind of a local version because we have diffeomorphisms which depend on generally on time and position. So it generalizes Galilean transformation.
Do you have to transform the zero I component of G?
So I have here just a spatial metric. So I have Gij and nothing else. So
do you set that G zero I is zero? Or?
So I have a non-relativistic theory which lives on a curved manifold,
right,
two-dimensional.
But I suppose your metric has a full component. It has some component as well.
My relativistic metric would have that, yeah.
But
could you view AI as G0I, for example? AI or AP?
You can do that, yeah.
So I think that's the answer to your question.
Sorry,
sir. G0I is basically AI.
Your
seeds are
time-dependent.
So psi is time and position. Depends on time and position, yeah. And it's spatial, yes. Anyway, so here is what happens for conventional S-wave superfluid. So let's go through that. So the action goes back to Popov and also Greitner, Wilczek, and Witten, and then Son and Wingate formulated it. So here is the action. So it's an action dependent on the Goldstone field through this integral. So here is the determinant of the metric because we are in curved space. Here is some function p of x. And the x is this combination which turns out to be invariant with respect to general coordinate transformations. So you see what appears here is a kind of non-relativistic combination dt theta minus di squared, basically, where we introduce a covariant derivative with respect to U1 field in this way. So what X actually does is a generalization of the chemical potential away from the ground state. So and if we plug it in into this function, we see that if we calculate now the equation of motions, for example, we get a mass conservation equation where superfluid density is given by the derivative of pressure with respect to X, which tells us that basically P is not any P, but it's a pressure. It's a pressure. And V is superfluid velocity, just a minus derivative of theta. So this is a leading order theory, which gives superfluid hydrodynamics. So, and I would like to tell you, so it's leading order in our power counting, which works as follows. So all dependence on theta here appears through derivatives. So it makes sense to say that the derivative of theta is of order one. So it doesn't have to be small. And also the other things like the ground A and G are also of order one. And now we will do a derivative expansion. So we will say that whenever we put extra derivative on that, it increases the order. So it's leading order in this power counting, which kind of allows us to have this kind of terms, right? So if you start to expand this function in thetas, you can have d theta to any power for a general equation of state, and it's still of order zero. So it fixes not only the dispersion relation, but it fixes all the interactions up to this order. So what one gets from here is superfluid hydrodynamics, yes. So now let's go to the chiral superfluid. So we need to get this. So remember that we had this symmetry breaking, and we introduced now the background field for U, but we didn't introduce it for S to V. So let's do that here. So we have orthogonal transformations in the space in the curved space. So we will introduce a field bind which will rotate under them. And so with this field bind, so the spatial field, purely spatial field bind, we can introduce a connection. So and it's written here. So it has a time component and the spatial component. And basically you see that this connection, this object transforms as a gauge field under local SO2V transformations. That's how we construct it. And also you see it's kind of peculiar. There is a magnetic field appearing here. And the reason is that we want to have this object to have a simple properties under this size, so under the non-relativistic diffeomorphisms. So it should transform simply as a one form. That's why this B appears here in the definition of omega t. And now it's quite simple. So the natural guess is just to take a modify the covariant derivative. So we have to couple the Goldstone field now not to U1, but we have to couple it to the broken combination of U and S and omega. So this is our broken generator. And so our theory is basically exactly the same as before, with a pressure of a function of that X I told you before. But now the covariant derivatives are modified and the omega appears there. So it turns out that for P plus IP, superfluid S is 1/2, but one can generalize it to higher partial wave superfluids easily. So now let's check if we get what we hoped. So do we get the modification? So this is very easy now because we have the action and we have background sources. We can differentiate with respect to them and get the U1 current. And you see that in the S-wave superfluid, we have this convective piece. But also on top of that, because of this modification, especially because of this B we're appearing there, we have an extra term, which is, we'll call it this edge current. Basically, it flows perpendicular to the density gradient. So whenever we have a boundary, the density starts to change, and we have a current which flows perpendicular to that. And this current carries this total angular momentum I told you before. And yes?
You could also have a series of reactors which was not topological, right?
So it depends in which phase you are, right?
So it's a possibility, right?
Yes. So
and so then you would still have a breaking of the SO2.
Yeah. So it does not matter if it's topologically non-trivial or trivial phase. The condensate is has the same form.
And the form of your covariant derivative is the same?
Yes.
But there shouldn't be an edge mode in that case.
So the edge mode is a, yes, there is no edge mode, but in the bulk, we still have this kind of condensate. So it still has these properties. The whole viscosity is still there and the edge current. So my theory is the same. I will comment hopefully on the edge modes a little bit. So, okay, in a similar way, we can calculate the stress tensor by differentiating with respect to the metric. And you see that we get this whole viscosity piece. and where whole viscosity is just given by the density multiplied by this S over 2. So in this way, we get this superfluid parity violating hydrodynamics. Now we would like to apply it and calculate something with it. So for example, one of the applications is vorticity. If you take this covariant derivative and take a curl of that, you'll get a vorticity. And so you see that as usual, if you have a magnetic field, it sources the vorticity. But in chiral superfluids, on top of that, there is also a term with which is curvature. So the curvature itself also plays a role of the source for vorticity. So for example, so superfluid are irrotational flows, right? But we know that we can accommodate vorticity with point-like vortices. So in this way, vorticity will appear. And for example, if we put our superfluid on a sphere and switch off the magnetic field, then only this term plays a role. And now we can calculate actually that the total integral vorticity is given by pi. And in fermionic superfluid, every vortex carries a unit of. Okay, so in experiments, you will start to rotate your superfluid, okay? So that's the way how to switch on magnetic field.
It's not really a gauge field or anything like that. It's just an arbitrary phase winding.
Yeah, it's a source, yes. It's not, we are not talking about superconductors here. So there these particles are not charged. But if you start to rotate, you effectively generate a magnetic field. And of course, then the lattice of vortices starts to appear because they have to carry this vorticity. So yeah, so on a superfluid, on a sphere, you will get non-trivial vorticity for P plus IP superfluid. And this means that you have to have two quantum vortices which will accommodate this vortices.
So curvature induces two vortices.
Two vortices in P plus IP, yes. Okay, so what we can also do is now we can calculate a linear response. So very easily, we have a theory of Goldstone bosons. We know how the current depends on Goldstone fields. So we switch on external source, solve the equation of motion for Goldstone boson, put Goldstone boson into the current, and get the response. So here, for example, is the calculation of response to external electromagnetic source. So there will be, the current will have several terms, but one of them will have kind of a Hall conductivity type. So it will respond to the electric field, which is and will be perpendicular to that. So, and the calculation shows that the Hall viscosity is given by this expression. It's quite interesting because if you want to take now a static limit or put both omega and p to zero, you have to be careful and know in which order you are doing this. So if you put first omega to zero and then push p to zero, then you get a finite result. But if you do it oppositely, so if you push first p to zero, then you kill the whole thing and there is no static Hall conductivity in the system. So the system responds to the gradient of the density, not to the electric field. Okay?
I have a dual question to change the question. The electric field means you tilt the thing that the particles are sitting in.
Okay, the electric field.
It's not really an electric field. It's a gradient of protection.
Yes. So with electric field, it's a little bit. Yeah, I think whenever you. Yeah, if you have inhomogeneities, it somehow will be related to the electric field. But I do not have at the moment. Very simple.
It's not just.
Okay, that's a good point. Yeah, so you can tilt your plane and gravitationally. Yeah. Sounds good. Yeah.
Gradient of the trapping potential is the electric field in the atomic system.
Okay.
So earlier in your presentation, you had linked the current to the pressure.
Current to the pressure?
Yes.
Yes. So my action is a pressure.
Yeah,
and,
right.
Yes.
So why did you replace pressure with electric field then? because there's no real electric field in this system. There's only a pressure.
So we discussed it right now, right?
Sorry,
so if
I didn't hear that.
So if you have a harmonic trap, or if you tilt, if you put a potential on your fermions, so static potential, so this will generate an electric field for you?
No, it generates a pressure in a neutral fluid. There's no electric field.
So what I'm saying is that you have a term in your, so you will have a term V of R psi. So you will have
and V is a potential, a scalar potential field.
It's like that. So yeah,
okay.
That's what I wanted to write.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's what P does as well.
I think this is what Walter was saying. I mean, E is just. I mean, you can only source this thing through team you knew, and the zero I and the zero zero pieces have to be everything else except for G that couples that doesn't couple to GIJ. But this thing's a neutral system, so the most you can do is put external forces on it. So the E and the B are just part of.
You can do that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I'm just not doing it in this way, but yeah, you can formulate it like that. Okay, in the similar way, we can calculate the response to the external metric perturbation. So if we take imagine you take an external metric which depends on time. So then you can see that there is a response of the XY component of T. And so this can be associated with a frequency-dependent Hall viscosity. And the result in our case is actually frequency-independent. So it reproduces what I showed you before. So actually, there is an interesting relation between Hall viscosity and conductivity at finite frequency, which was found by Hoyos and so on, and also kind of developed more by Bradlin et al. So I just mentioned that this relation is satisfied by this calculation. So the practical way how to maybe measure the Hall viscosity is to measure the P dependence of the Hall conductivity. Okay, let me tell you a little bit about the vortex solution. So this is a different application. So in chiral condensates, we expect, so the ground state rotates, right? So it means that vortices and antivortices, they are not equivalent to each other. We should see it somehow. And so the way how to see it is to look at the, so vortex is a depletion in the superfluid. So as we go far away, it kind of has a tail, kind of depletion, how it approaches the ground superfluid density. So in this tail, or the whole depletion profile should differ for vortices and antivortices. And this is what we can calculate reliably, at least when we are far away from the core. So we take a vortex ansatz. So there is only angular part of the frequency, and it goes like 1 over r. We put it into our Euler equation with the Hall viscosity and everything. And so, and then now we have to solve this equation and see how the density changes, how it behaves far away from the core. So if we do it in kind of expansion, we see that the leading order of the tail, so the deviation of vortex density, actual density from the background density, behaves like 1 over r squared. And it doesn't depend on these parameters s. So it depends on the speed of sound, but not on S. So this means that at this level, we cannot see the difference. But if we do a finer kind of expansion, so if we go to a subleading order, 1 over r to the fourth, then you see that there is a parameter S appearing. So the difference between the density of vortices and antivortices can be obtained if we measure carefully how the density, the superfluid density behaves far away from the vortex. Okay, so this is a comment on these gapless modes, which we talked about before. So the superfluid which we are talking about is topological in a sense that in the BCS regime, so if we are weakly coupled, if we are in a weakly coupled regime, then we expect to have this gapless edge modes. And so I did not talk anything about fermionic gapless modes here. One may wonder if they are there or not. So I would like to argue that we take them into account, but they're hidden in our equation of state. Yeah, so it's very simple. As we, so this gapless modes appear when we kind of come closer to the critical point. So, and exactly at that point, the equation of state, P as a function of mu, develops a non-analyticity. So in terms of Goldstone bosons, it becomes quite a nasty theory, which is non-local. So this means that the only way how this can appear actually is from integration of gapless fermionic modes. So basically what I'm saying is that the edge modes are kind of hidden in the non-analyticity of the function P. So it would be interesting to decouple them back because we do not like non-local theories. So, but this I do not know how to do so far.
Yeah. But can you say that there will be a Majorana mode of the vertex based on some general argument within your theory?
Yes. This will. So when did I start? 15 more minutes. Okay, then I will skip this. There is a connection to quantum Hall physics, so one can reformulate it, and I will not talk about it here. What the last thing I would like to talk about is the following. So I remind you how we did the construction. So we modified our definition of the covariant derivative by this extra spin connection part. But one can ask the following question. So what we are building here is an effective field theory of bosons. There are no fermions here. So the question is if we can get rid of field binds somehow. So usually field binds are important when we deal with fermions. And here we deal with bosons. Well, can we do that? Can we write everything in terms of metric only, right? There are fermions in microscopic theory. There are no fermions in our. So Goldstone bosons are bosons, right? So they will be in the microscopic theory.
They're gas excitations.
Yes.
So they're fermions.
They're also gas excitations at the edge.
So I do not want to talk about the edge now. I'm just want to talk about the bulk. Okay, so let me show you how it works. So I believe it can be done, but it's not so obvious to see it in the original formulation. But we can reformulate our theory, and then I think it will become clear. So in 2+1 dimensions, there is a nice correspondence between Goldstone theory and electrodynamics, right? So electrodynamics has just, in two spatial dimensions, has just one transverse polarization, which is 1 degree of freedom, which is exactly the 1 degree of freedom of the Goldstone theory. So we can relate the photon to a Goldstone boson here. And to do that, we just take our U1 current and write it in the dual form. So we introduce a gauge field small a and relate it to the current in the following, in this way. So now the conservation law of current is trivial, right? It's just a Bianchi identity. So the conservation of current is trivially satisfied. And we can rewrite actually our theory in terms of some electrodynamics, but since our original theory was nonlinear, the electrodynamics which we are talking about here is also nonlinear. So I show you the result of that. So we take this A and construct a magnetic field, small b, and an electric field, small e. And now the superfluid Lagrangian is written here, so it has a kinetic term, e squared over 2b basically, minus the potential term, which is a energy density as a function of B. So B has an interpretation of the superfluid density, if we just look into this expression. And it's very easy now to couple it to external U1 field by just writing a Chern-Simons term, A wedge D small a. So this is a description, dual description of S-wave superfluid. So the question now is what should we do if we want to have chiral superfluid, and the answer is we have to write a different Chern-Simons term, right? So remember, the broken generator, the broken gauge field is not A, but the combination A minus S omega. So I can write it just like that. So I can write a Chern-Simons term, which is called the Wenzi term, where we take our spin connection omega and make wedge d small a. So in this way, it couples to a superfluid through this Chern-Simons term. And one can check that you get, it's exactly equivalent to the theory I talked about before. So what is easy to do, and the reason why I'm showing it here, is one can show quite easily. So you can take this, and up to a surface term, you can put the derivative on omega here. And then what you get is something like a gravito-magnetic and gravito-electric fields, which I call B omega and E omega. And these guys are easily written in terms of the metric itself. So actually this B is just one half of the Ricci scalar, and the electric field is just gravito-electric field can be written in terms of the Christoffel symbol. So in this way, we can eliminate the field bind from the theory by going into the dual description. All right, so that's it. So let me just summarize. So what I was talking about here, an effective hydrodynamic theory of a Galilean invariant theory, which breaks parity. So in two spatial dimensions. So it gives rise to the Hall viscosity and to the edge current, which produces a total angular momentum. Yeah, so there are some questions which are kind of would be interesting to think about. So first of all, as we talked about these Majorana modes, which live on the boundary, so it would be nice so people do not like non-local theory of Goldstone bosons, so it would be nice to decouple it back, or to make it more theoretically interesting. Instead of doing some boundary stuff, we can tune the theory to the critical point, and we want to. At that point, the gap closes for fermions, and we would like to construct an effective, not the effective, but the theory of this critical point.
So, which, you believe that the Goldstone coupling is relevant at the critical point?
The Goldstone coupling is.
The coupling to the Goldstone boson. So, of course, there's a free fermion theory for the critical point.
Yes.
You can bulk the gapless fermion at that point, right?
Yes. So what I would like to do, I would like to incorporate this symmetries, all these symmetries which I was talking about, to this fermion.
You haven't done that yet.
Huh?
You haven't done that yet.
No. I do not know the answer to your question yet. And yeah, of course, the application to helium 3, where you have also spins degrees of freedom, and you have ferromagnetism with magnons with quadratic dispersion relation, would be also very interesting. So a lot of work on helium 3 was done long time before, but yeah, it might be interesting to look into this once again. Yeah, just maybe with this symmetries argument in the mind. All right, that's it.
Any further questions? So maybe I can speculate on an answer to Subir's question. I think the coupling will be the coupling will be relevant. So you probably will see some subdominant non-analytic behavior to some quantities, for example, some kinetic coefficients that you can compute. Probably these are subdominant.
So irrelevant.
Probably irrelevant because the Goldstone boson has a derivative coupling.
Yeah, that's what I was.